From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was a risk for Gary Steingart to write a memoir at this point in his life. He's still pretty young, not that you have to be a certain age to write a memoir, but his parents are still alive, and the book is very much about his relationship with them. So it's probably easier to write the kinds of books he was writing, beautifully crafted, bitingly funny, satirical fiction. And it was intense writing the memoir, he says, recalling the experience of emigrating with his parents from Russia to Queens, just as the Soviet Union was crumbling and Reagan was ascending. But Steingart says if you're going to write a memoir and protect yourself, what's the point? Today in the program, he'll join us to talk about the book. It's called Little Failure, after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Gary Steingart is joining us to talk about his latest book, which is being described as a departure for him, though if you read it, you'll recognize some of the ideas, some of the themes, and of course the fact that it's funny. Most of you know his work through his satirical novels like The Russian Debutante's Handbook and Super Sad True Love Story. The new book is a memoir, and talk about true love stories that are super sad. It's about his relationship with his parents. That's one of the love stories. He tells of coming with them from the crumbling Soviet Union in 1979 as a terrified 7-year-old to Queens. In those days, he was scared of pretty much everything outside of his apartment in St. Petersburg, scared of people, of the cold, even the most modest of heights. His mother has a theory as to why he was so scared. We'll get to that a little bit later on the program. And speaking of his mother, she's the one who came up with the term of endearment that is also the title of the new book, Little Failure. Gary Steingart is joining us to talk about it today. You can join us, too, if you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Gary Steingart's writing has appeared in The New Yorker and Esquire, GQ, among many other publications. He teaches creative writing these days at Columbia University, and he's joining us from a radio station on the campus there at the school. And Gary Steingart, welcome. Thank you very much for doing this.
Great. Great to be here.
So I guess I wanted to start with the question of, and I know you've gotten it a lot, but why a memoir? I guess the first question is, did you realize it was kind of a risk early on doing a memoir?
Well, you know, it's interesting because people always say, well, you're 41. Aren't you too young to write a memoir? But yeah. 41 feels really old to me. I mean, I'm barely alive as we speak. You know, I had a very sickly childhood followed by a sickly adulthood. And I think most Russian men anyway, don't live that long. So 41 seems like an advanced age for me. And I'm just happy to get this thing out of the way, you know.
What do you mean, get it out of the way? Is that something that you felt like you sort of had to work through to move on?
I do think so. I mean, I think that the three books I've written, the novels I've written, all of them are adventures of a kind. The Russian Debutante's Handbook was written when I was just in my 20s and at Oberlin College. And so it was the kind of, you know, young man's novel where you write about the things that are interesting to you as a 20-year-old. And Absurdistan was a kind of picaresque adventure through the former Soviet states. And Super Sad True Love Story was a book about technology, really, but also about the impossibility of love. But they all featured these sort of nebbishy Russian-Jewish protagonists, and, right. and that's sort of been very autobiographical. So in a way, the Little Failure is a kind of fire sale where everything about me must go, and everything you've ever wanted to learn about me, and maybe things you didn't want to learn about me, are all presented for the reader.
You said that you felt emotionally distant enough from some of this to be able to write about it. Does there have to be a kind of distance for you to get perspective to write about it, do you think?
Sure. I mean, you can't start out with this feeling of the underlying emotions, be they sadness or rage or anything that sort of can cloud the way you approach the work, that can make you spin it in a certain way to make yourself feel good. You know, nothing in this book would make anyone feel good, I think. It's as truthful as I could possibly muster. There's a kind of honesty that comes from having gone through these events so many times, gone over them so many times in my mind, that there's really no – the benefit of you know, going through them isn't there anymore. Mm-hmm. They just need to be set down on paper and released into the world.
There's a photograph of you when you were almost two. And I should say that there's a photograph at the beginning of all the chapter headings. And I guess before I get to this particular photograph, let me ask you about that. When did you come upon that idea, the idea of using photographs as sort of signposts at the beginning of the chapters?
Well, we live in a very visual age. People don't really want to read a book for the most part. There's too many words, and there's just word after word after word. It's a nightmare. We're used to shorter bursts of information, and we're used to those bursts of information having a kind of visual curatorial aspect. So before I wrote the book, obviously I made a trailer with you know, James Franco Rashida Jones and Jonathan Franzen. So there was already a kind of visual component before the book was even released. And the book, I think, is helpful for the reader because I changed so much. My Punim, my face, just went through so many permutations. I was this sort of cute, angelic little kid, and then I became this kind of swarthy, furry individual. And you can sort of see that chapter by chapter, the way my face kind of disintegrates and becomes more and more problematic. So I thought that would be fun for the reader to see, you know, how a cute little boy becomes a furry, furry man.
So there's that photograph. You were, I think, you were almost 2 years old. It was taken at this photo studio there in the Soviet Union. You're on the verge of tears, and as I said in the introduction, there you're scared of the telephone, which you're holding in your hand. Oh. You're scared of everything outside of your apartment at the time. Later in life, you asked your mother, "Why was I so scared of everything?" And she said this. She said, "Because you were born a Jewish person." Explain that, will you?
Yeah, it was funny. And she said that very recently. I think it was a couple of years ago because when I was interviewing her for the memoir to see what she would come up with. I think a lot of this book is sort of tracing the way my parents became the kind of people they are, for better or for worse. Right. And in talking to my mother, this theme of anxiety came up. You know, her mother was accidentally responsible for the death of her sister, my grandmother. She was rocking her in a carriage and she died. There's this horrible fear of being buried alive, which makes no sense until you realize that a huge chunk of my relatives were buried alive by the Germans when they invaded what is now Belarus. So, you know, it's sort of – this is a trip down anxiety lane and trying to figure out how we became the frightened people that we are. And there's real antecedents for all of the, you know, so being buried alive is something that happened to my ancestors. And now my fear is, you know, being in contained objects like subway cars under the ground. There's a kind of things move from one kind of anxiety to another. And doing this memoir, a lot of the work I'm trying to do is trying to figure out how historically I became the person I am. My parents became the people they are. Their grandparents were the people they are. And it's really fascinating. I mean, you can draw these wonderful sort of lines and see how things happen, even though there is this huge event, which is us leaving the Soviet Union and not being subjected to the kind of, you know, invasions by Hitler and Stalin anymore.
Yeah. The research you did amounted to all kinds of things, certainly hours and hours of interviews with your parents, video interviews that you did in Russia later, which I want to come back to a little bit later. But I wondered, when you approached them, your mother and your father, about this idea of – did they know that you were thinking of writing a memoir? I mean, did they know that you were doing research, I guess?
Yeah, that's how I framed it. You know, otherwise, why would they do it? I said, you know, that I'm going to write a memoir. And they said, sure. You know, they were very open to it. And they gave a lot of time, hours and hours and hours, 20, 30, 40, 50. I don't even know how many. I think it took an entire summer just to go through the audio files and the video files. And also I interviewed all of or as many as I could friends of mine from high school, from Hebrew school, which takes up many chapters throughout the book, from Oberlin College. It was you know, I just wanted to capture the flavor. And I also wanted to correct my own memories when I felt that they were shaky. So people would tell me things like, you know, that 3-day acid trip that you remember in high school, it never happened. So. You can't quite use that.
It's interesting, though. I mean, what did I kept noticing these kind of offhanded disclaimers in the book, things like, if I remember this correctly, or as memory serves, things like that. So did you entirely ditch it if you couldn't track it down?
If I couldn't track it down, if it didn't make any sense, if there was absolutely no corroborative evidence, or if I didn't remember it very strongly. I mean, there's certain things that I remember so strongly that I know that my memory couldn't lie unless I'm, you know, really mentally ill and have made it all up from scratch. But I don't think that's the case.
Yeah.
I think from the very beginning, I was very keen on writing things down, on keeping records of everything that happened. You know, when I was 5, I wrote my first little novel. When I was 10 and 11 and 12, I wrote all these different things in Hebrew school, science fiction novels with titles like The Challenge and Invasion from Outer Space and The Gonora, which was a takedown of the Torah. You know, Exodus became Sexodus.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. So I was always keen on doing that, and my parents were very nice in the sense that they preserved a lot of these materials. You know, they had no idea that I would become a writer someday, but they kept all this stuff, and that's one reason I can sort of go back and try to check what my language sounded like, what I was like. One of the big problems with writing memoir is that, unlike fiction, sometimes you have to sort of invent the dialogue, and I try to do this as rarely as possible because you never get it 100% right, but you have to sort of try to recreate what conversation sounded like, and of course you're never going to have 100% fidelity, but it was important for me to try to get it as close as possible.
Your father said to you at one point, and I'm not sure at what point in all of this process, but you mentioned this in the book, he said, "Don't mention the names of my relatives in this book that you're writing." And you said, "Why?" And talk a little bit about that exchange. He says, "I don't want you to write like a self-hating Jew."
Yes, and I think that's been a big bone of contention for the last 3 books I've written, which are not, well, they're not celebrations of Judaism and Israel. And my father, those are the 2 of the most important things in his life, Judaism and Israel. And while I bear neither any ill will, they're simply not the kind of, I think, the kind of exodus, Leon Uris exodus-like celebrations of either the faith or the country. And my own experiences in Hebrew school were very melancholy and had more downs than ups, I would say. So don't write like a self-hating Jew has always been his mantra, and I don't think I've ever been able to fulfill it. So that's one of the big tensions in the book, because he grew up in the Soviet Union, where being Jewish after the Six-Day War, after 1967, and the Soviet Union's sort of very anti-Semitic turn was very difficult for him. We emigrate to New York, which is chock full of wonderful Jews who don't think twice usually about being Jewish, for whom it's just an identity and sometimes even a very happy and helpful one. But there's not obviously not the kind of anti-Semitism in New York that there was in Leningrad. And so there's a kind of dissonance there because his enemies were anti-Semitic non-Jews, whereas when I was growing up, my enemies, if that's what they could be called, but the kids who made fun of me were all Jewish. So there's a very strange feeling of emigrating and then being sent to a Hebrew school, and the people that are supposed to be your compatriots are not. And when you graduate from it, and I went to Stuyvesant High School, and I began to make friends with all kinds of people, Jewish, non-Jewish, non-white, it didn't matter. And I really felt myself slowly becoming closer to what feels like a community. And it wasn't a community based on ethnicity or religion or race. It was a community based on shared interests.
I just wonder what kind of a negotiation it ever was between what it is you talked with your parents about what you would include and maybe what you wouldn't. I mean, there's a story that your father tells you, which is, I think, one of the most beautiful parts of the book, when he was a small child and how the fact was people were starving in Leningrad, you know, and he feeds a dog a butter sandwich.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at first he says, I don't want you to put that in the book. He's kind of ashamed of it, and it's such a profound kind of story. I wanted you to talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, no, people were starving. It was the evacuation from Leningrad, the German troops, the famous siege of Leningrad, which killed probably over 1 million people. And my father was evacuated with his grandmother. And this was, I mean, when you think about what he went through, it was absolutely unbelievable. He was evacuated. The German airplanes would swoop in, swoop down, and try to bomb the trains that they were being evacuated in, and they would have to hide under the trains, under the rail carriages, to escape the German bombs. Then when he got there, one of his best friends died of malnutrition or of a disease. He doesn't know why, but he was this tiny little kid. He was his best friend, and he died. His cousin kept having to jump out of a second floor window because the rats were trying to eat them. There was no food, in other words, right. You know. And so he had a butter sandwich and he fed it to a dog, and he felt very bad about that because obviously human beings were starving. But so he didn't know whether or not I should include that in the book. But, you know, this is one of those things where in memoir, you know, the way you see things is not the way others will see them.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, what to me was a very touching story about a boy who's lost everything, and here he is and he's sharing this sandwich with this dog. I mean, it's enough to make you cry. And he just doesn't, you know, in his mind, that at first was not something he wanted to include. But I'm so glad that in the end he relented, and I said, you know, and I think it's a very touching example of just how different our lives were,
yeah.
You know, growing up. It's not just the difference between generations. It's the difference between growing up. His father was killed when he was just a little kid in the war. He was part of the Soviet forces trying to break out of the siege of Leningrad, and he was shot down. Can you imagine? I mean, just at a tiny age being told that your father was dead at the front. It's so different from the way I grew up,
right. Obviously.
Even in the Soviet Union, we had a fairly privileged position relative to other people, of course. And then we came to America. And I mean, I guess writing this kind of book, you know, any sense of unhappiness that you had with your parents growing up, because they were really tough people, as many immigrant parents are, you know, become a lawyer or else was sort of their mantra. But any of the feelings of not being able to understand where they came from evaporated as I wrote this book and became replaced with this kind of feelings of sadness that they weren't able to grow up in a normal country and that they weren't able to accomplish the kinds of things that they wanted to because simply it wasn't going to happen.
Gary Steingart is with us. His new book is called Little Failure, a Memoir. And you can join us if you like, if you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Gary Steingart is with us. Many of you know him from his novels, among them Super Sad True Love Story, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, Absurdistan, beautifully crafted, really funny. His latest book is a memoir, the story of his Russian-Jewish family leaving a crumbling Soviet Union for the United States when he was only 7 years old. They landed in Queens. Steingart's young love for Lenin became a love for Reagan, at least at first. The book is called Little Failure, a Memoir, and he's joining us from the campus of Columbia University in New York City. I wanted to ask you about the influence of stories on your life. There's this story that you tell about, this is the summer of, I think it's 1978, you're vacationing with your mother on the Black Sea, and you write about standing in line, this long line, to speak on the phone with your father, and he would tell you stories over the phone.
Yeah, no, he was, and this is, I guess, very timely because it was the Crimea, Yalta,
yeah.
Where we would vacation. It was a very strange experience because there were sanatoria for wealthy apparatchiks, you know, generals in the army and stuff, and they would have these luxurious digs, and we would stand for hours just to get water and then for hours just to get on the telephone. And my father would constantly tell me these stories and send me letters. Mm. In which he would tell these stories, these adventure stories about the Turkish Navy invading Russia and the Russians fighting back. I mean, wow, when you think about the events of these days, it's very prescient. But I was in love, you know, it was sort of Ian Fleming on the cheap, you know.
Right.
The Soviet version of James Bond. And I loved it. And there were, you know, I loved doggies, so there were all these German shepherds trying to hunt down the Turkish Navy. And, you know. But, and then later when we moved to America, he would tell me these even funnier stories that he called the Planet of the Yids. And it was about this Jewish planet that's constantly being bombarded by Slavs with their pork torpedoes. And the Jews keep trying to build a kosher shield to prevent their planet from being larded with this pork. Just completely insane and outrageous stuff. But, you know, when you think about the kind of satires like Absurdistan that I would write later on, you could really see the way that that would be. And, you know, and they're funny stories, but they're also self-deprecating and just lots of fun. So that, I think, was part of my the idea that storytelling was important. And when I got to Hebrew school, you know, and I was this little asthmatic, furry kid with not a lick of English to him. I had an accent for a very long time. And all I could do was write, and I began to write stories, and that's how I made my first friends.
Yeah.
So I went from being the, you know, there were all those movies, Red Dawn, Red Gerbil, Red Hamster, whatever.
Right.
I went from being the Red Gerbil into, you know, a kind of clubbable fruitcake who told stories.
Yeah, because he could write.
So that was because I could write.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And when you write, there's no accent. It's just words.
Well, read that section of the book, will you? This
sure.
is such a terrific part. I'm not sure if – I think you've sort of set it up in that sense, but
– Yeah, let me see. Well, this is Hebrew school. I'm about 11 years or 12 years old, probably 11. And we have a substitute teacher who comes in who's very nice, who's very encouraging, and her name is Miss S. And so this is what happens one day. At the end of the English period, when a book about a mouse who has learned how to fly in an airplane has been thoroughly dissected, Miss S. announces, "And now Gary will read from his novel." His what? Oh, but it doesn't matter, because I'm standing there holding my composition notebook straight from the Square Deal Notebook people of Dayton, Ohio, zip code 45463. And looking out at me are the boys beneath their little flying saucer yarmulkes, and the girls with their sweet aromatic bangs, their blouses studded with stars. And there's Miss S., who I'm already terribly in love with, but who I've recently learned has a fiancé. Not sure what that means, can't be good, but whose bright American face is not just encouraging me, but priding me on. Am I scared? No, I am eager to begin my new life. Introduction, I say. The mysterious race. Before the age of dinosaurs, there was human life on Earth. They looked just like the man of today, but they were a lot more intelligent than the man of today. Slowly, Miss S. says. Read slowly, Gary. Let us enjoy the words. I breathe that in. Miss S. wants to enjoy my words. And then, slower, they built all kinds of spaceships and other wonders. But at that time, the Earth circled the moon, because the moon was bigger than the Earth. One day, a gigantic comet came and blew up the moon to the size it is today. As I'm reading, despite the many errors, I'm hearing a different language come out of my mouth. I do justice to the many misspellings, the Earth circled the moon, and the Russian accent is still thick, but I'm speaking in what is more or less comprehensible English. And as I'm speaking, along with my strange new English voice, I'm also hearing something entirely foreign to the squealing and shouting that constitutes the background noise of my Hebrew school. Silence. The children are silent. They are listening to my every word, and they will listen to the story for the next 5 weeks as well, because Miss S. will designate the end of every English period as Gary novel time, and they will shout out throughout the English period, "When will Gary read already?" The school is close to Long Island, by the way. And I will sit there in my chair, oblivious to all but Miss S.'s smile, excused from following the discussion of the mouse who learned how to fly, so that I may go over the words I will soon read to my adoring audience. And God bless these kids for giving me a chance. May their God bless them, everyone.
You loved the performance part, didn't you, of that?
Yes. It was strange. I mean, there I was reading, you know, here's this kid who keeps his mouth shut, doesn't want to speak in English because it never comes out right. And then I'm tasked with all of a sudden going in front of the whole class that you just, you know, just the day before was making fun of everything about me, my big fur coat, my giant fur hat, you know, we didn't have any clothes. I had two shirts, one pair of pants, and all the kids their parents would gather around, you know, Batman and Green Lantern T-shirts that they had outgrown to give to me. So I was like the charity case of the school. And all of a sudden, here I am, and I'm talking to them, and they're all listening. And they're not laughing at me. They want to hear more. It was a grand shock. And I think in my mind, it just always associated the idea that if you have something to say, you won't be made fun of.
Yeah. Was there ever a moment you thought about acting?
Yes. In fact, I took my wife, she was then my girlfriend, got me acting lessons with Louise Lasser, who's quite well known. Mm-hmm. She was in Bananas and recently on an episode of Girls, actually. And she was a tough cookie. And as with always, I try to sort of get the audience to like me and to make jokes. And she wouldn't have any of it. And she would just scream, "You're fake and manipulative." And I thought, I'm a New Yorker. Of course I'm fake and manipulative. How am I going to survive in this town, you know, without that? But it was a very interesting class.
But you always figured you would write. I mean, was it just always part of the plan even? I mean, you were writing your first novel when you were five.
Well, yes, until we got a television set, because for the longest time, my parents didn't have a TV set, which is partly why I spoke Russian with an accent, because there was no, you know, there was nobody to teach me how people spoke on the A-Team or Knight Rider or whatever those shows were. So I never learned, you know, Valley Girl or California English. And you went inside our parents' house and it was all Chekhov, and you went to Hebrew school, it was all Genesis. And so there wasn't enough to get by on. But after a while, I became much more interested in just the way people spoke. And then what happened was we got a TV, and my love of writing began to wane, because it was all very quickly replaced by the fact that I could watch Three's Company and Buck Rogers in the 25th Century and all these different things. And so for a while, my interest really waned, and I wanted to, you know, we were relatively poor, and all I wanted to do was go to Wall Street and become a really great, you know, crook, like an investment banker. I remember we watched Wall Street together as a family, and I thought, this is great, just you can't get caught. Yeah. You know, that was the big mistake of the Charlie Sheen character. So all through high school, and I went to Stuyvesant High School, which is a very competitive math and science high school. I wasn't a great student, but I still harbored these dreams of becoming, you know, an analyst for Bear Stearns or whatever, and then moving up and becoming a real criminal. and then I followed a girl to Oberlin.
Yeah.
I thought I was dating her. I was wrong. We were never really dating, but I followed her to Oberlin, where writing was, again, something that people really loved, and it wasn't there was no shame in being a writer. There was also – it was excellent to be an immigrant. Mm-hmm. All those years of pretending that I wasn't a Russian because of the evil empire speech and stuff like that. I remember even in Hebrew school I was telling kids that I was born in Berlin. In Hebrew school I was trying to convince Jewish kids I was a German.
Right. You know, that's
how awful being a Russian was. But all of a sudden at Oberlin, being an immigrant was the coolest thing – well, one of the coolest things you could be, because everyone was just this – sort of native-born, rich, white kid. And so being different was great. So, I wish I could get my accent back. You know, I wish I could wear one of those Kazakh uniforms with the bullets, you know, across the visor. And, you know, being the other was wonderful.
Yeah.
And that's when I started to write again. And I started to write very much about growing up in Russia and growing up in a lot of the stuff that made it into the memoir began as stories that I would write at Oberlin.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about. It seems like that, when you found that you could mine that part of your life, that seemed – I don't know if this is right, but was it a kind of a turning point in terms of your writing? I mean, because you've – for example, you write about this – you refer to a novel that you had written and you included the term little failure in the first chapter, which you had submitted to this writing program at the very prestigious program at the University of Iowa.
Yeah.
You didn't get in. And I'm wondering what was the writing like then compared to the stuff that started to really work?
Well, actually, the University of Iowa rejected pretty much the first chapters of the Russian Debutante's Handbook.
Wow.
So, that's where the term little failure was used. So my first published novel was essentially rejected by Iowa. And I remember being very, very hurt and thinking, wow, maybe I should really stop writing because, you know, if Iowa says I'm no good, then how good can I be, you know?
Yeah.
But yes, that was – I knew that – I started to realize at Oberlin that the story I had, which was this sort of grand 20th century story of – two superpowers, one failing, the other still not failing, although it would go on to fail pretty badly in the 21st century. But growing up in the U.S. and the USSR, there's sort of gigantic historical set piece. And then the real human drama that accompanied it, and also the great sense of humor that my parents both had, that my grandmothers had, It was a funny story. It was a tragic story. It was, if literature survives on tension, you've got to have a kind of tension between what happens between your characters and between your characters and themselves. There was more tension here at the last, for 30 novels. And I really began to appreciate that fact. And that began to spur me on to doing the kind of work that I started doing. I grew up with political jokes, Brezhnev jokes, and all the books that I started to write, Russian Debutante's Handbook, Absurdistan, they all had that kind of comedic, snide kind of comedic element to them. Because Jewish humor, Soviet Jewish humor, is this kind of humor from the edge of the grave where things are awful and everything's about to fall apart and who knows when the bullets are going to start flying and when you're going to be buried alive with your family and God knows what else will happen next and then you'll be sent to the gulag and you'll lose your fingers as some of my uncles did, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to laugh while you can.
In 1996, you had, I guess it was 96 when you had the first panic attack. It was at a bookstore, The Strand, in New York. Had a book about Russian architecture in your hand at the time. And you've referred to this. You mentioned writing in The New Yorker in 2003. You mentioned that your panic attack was this offshoot of your parents' fear of not being allowed to leave Russia, which was a real fear for them at some point. How are you understanding that now? Do you still feel that way?
Well, I don't want to give too much away about the way the book ends, but this panic attack would happen whenever I approached. Well, the first one happened when I saw a picture of a church in a book on the architecture of St. Petersburg. The next panic attack happened when I was actually back in St. Petersburg in the very late 90s and passed by this church. So something happened between me and members of my family in front of that church, and the book is kind of, in a small way, a mystery story about trying to figure out what happened. And it's not until I go back with my parents to see that church that I figure out what it was. But there was definitely a fear of not being able to leave Russia. And it's a strange fear that I've always had whenever I do return to Russia, and I've been back countless times. One of my favorite things about going to Russia is leaving Russia. You know, when you get on an airplane and all your exit visas have been stamped correctly, because there's also, there's all this nonsense, bureaucratic nonsense. You have to have an exit visa to leave that has to be stamped at the airport. But there's always this feeling that, in some ways, because when my parents were leaving, many people weren't allowed to leave. They became what was called refuseniks. And it was a terrible, terrible life because you basically lived in this kind of limbo where you weren't allowed to leave Russia. And inside Russia, you were basically treated as a second-class citizen. You couldn't get a real job. It was, you were basically erased in a kind of Orwellian way. So that was a real fear. And, my parents had my parents, I think, knew for the most part that they would be able to leave, but I think in my mind, part of me was still haunted by that thought that we would be stuck there forever. And the more I visit Russia, the more I realize just how important it is not to live in Russia and how deeply I hope for many of my friends in Russia who also want to leave that someday they'll be given the chance.
I love how you describe being in Russia. Your relationship with the country, which is a bit, you say, like the weather in Russia in spring, cold and gloomy with some outlandish bursts of warmth.
Yeah, it's it's a fairly depressive experience, but when the people, the intelligentsia, if you will, there's so many well-educated and kind and thoughtful people in Russia who are in this oppressive, never-endingly oppressive quasi-imperialist system and that they can't get out of. But that doesn't make them any worse. It makes them, in fact, in my mind, all the better for being able to preserve their kindness and their sensitivities. So sometimes you meet them and you go for a few drinks, well, a lot of drinks given that it's Russia, and you do feel this incredible warmth. You feel like you're closer to them than you would be to people in the West where we all keep our guards up a little bit. But, this is the magic of Russia, is that people do want to let you in.
You dedicate the book in part to your parents, but also to your therapist, your analyst. You said that in some way the memoir is a product of psychoanalysis, that this kind of therapy, this is how you've put it, this kind of therapy has a lot to do with writing. Explain what you mean.
Well, when we were talking about honesty before and trying to figure out what's real and what's merely a posture. You know, sometimes when I read books, not just books today, but books throughout history, I feel that the writer, and sometimes it could be a brilliant writer, but the writer needs to present a certain version of him or herself and of perhaps their family and of perhaps their religion or ethnicity or nationality, and that there's this the importance of being, of glorifying some part of themselves or of their ancestry. And that's not how I wanted to write. I wanted to write with as much honesty as possible. And I think, you know, many readers who have read this book think, my God, you know, from age 15 to 25, you were a real jerk, Gary, you know. And I think that's absolutely true. There were a lot of difficulties growing up, and I didn't overcome those difficulties on my own. In fact, I internalized them, and I treated others the way others had treated me. There's absolutely nothing saintly about any of this. And I think that that's something that happens when you're in psychoanalysis. You're able to separate the truth from the delusions that you have about yourself and where you came from. It's never perfect. There are things in this book that people might be able to contest. But this is as close as I could get to laying down what my life was like. A lot of it felt like psychoanalysis in the sense that I would wake up in the morning before starting to write a chapter and say, okay, what? I'm 11 years old. What's my life like now? Where are my friends? Where are the kids who make fun of me? What strategies am I going to use to make sure my parents don't fight, and that I can get through Hebrew school without any insults thrown my way? And that's the kind of stuff that you try to dredge up in analysis as well, aided by dreams and reading the things that you wrote back then. There were some confluences there. The thing I have to tell you, though, is that there really isn't any kind of catharsis when you finish a memoir like that. You see yourself. I mean, you don't develop any more, you know, feelings of safety or security upon reading something like that, upon writing it and then also reading it. As you go through the different processes of editing it, you start to realize just what you do start to think is that the person that you've written about exists only partly now, because so much of that person is gone. And that's just – it's not writing the memoir that did it. It's just the wheels of time. You just become a very different person. You know, at 41, I'm as different from age 30 as I am from being, at age 7. Mm-hmm. It's just a different person.
So interesting too. There was I read an interview with you in Interview magazine, and she mentioned that she felt like at the end of the book she knew you better than she knew her husband of 20 years or something.
Yeah, that was the wonderful writer Francine Prose.
Francine Prose, yeah.
Yeah. That was the first interview I ever did, and when she said that, I thought, okay, I guess people are getting a lot out of this book, whether they like it or not. There's certainly you do get to know a lot about me, and I think for many people it's too much. They don't want that much. They'd rather just get the basics down. But here you are getting an all-you-can-eat meal. There's many helpings at the salad bar of Steingart here. So it's a lot. It feels like it's a slightly different memoir from the ones that I've encountered. The closest I can think of, and it's one of my favorite, is Mary Carr's work. The Liars Club, for example, but also Lit. She's wonderful, and she's been very supportive. She gave a wonderful quote to the book, but she's also very helpful when it comes to time to talking about what it's like to write a memoir of that's this honest.
But it's I've heard this asked of you before: is how did this change your writing, or will this change your writing? And beyond the form, has it really changed your writing? It's still satirical. It's still funny. It still has the same kind of beautiful, writing. I mean, has it in some way changed?
Well, it's changed the writing for the next book.
Yeah.
Because I can't exactly return to the themes of Russian Jewish immigration from the former Soviet Union in the same way I can. It's we've given away all the trade secrets in this book. There's not much more I can tell you, about all the things that have happened to us. So there's a challenge there. The challenge is now you've got to write about something completely different or something somewhat different. You can't keep relying on these stables of characters that you've developed who are different, I think, but share certain ethnic and religious and often bodily traits. So whatever autobiographical material I was using for my first three novels, I can no longer really rely upon it. But that opens up a great sense of freedom as well, because now I can leave a little bit. I don't know if I'm sure I'll come back at some point, but the super sad true love story had my typical Russian Jewish nebbish protagonist, but the other protagonist was this very young Korean American woman named Eunice Park, and writing her was wonderfully liberating for me, just talking to somebody with a voice that was completely different from the kind of voice I usually used in my books. So there's an excitement that this memoir did put a kind of a hiatus on my exploration of the Russian Jewish post-Soviet psyche.
Gary Steingart is with us. His book is called Little Failure, and we'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer Gary Steingart. We're talking about his new book, Little Failure. He's joining us from New York City, from a studio at Columbia University. You gathered your family with you in Russia in 2011. Your mother hadn't been back since her mother had died 24 years before that. Your father hadn't really been back at all since you all left. Yeah. How did your parents feel about going back?
Well, there was a lot of sort of nostalgia in some ways, but overall, you know, they didn't feel great being in Russia. Yeah. It wasn't this great homecoming. Most of the relatives aren't there, so there's not that element of sort of seeing the family. St. Petersburg, Leningrad, when we were growing up, it's one of these Potemkin village type places where you can walk down one of the main streets and everything looks gilded and beautiful, and then you step a few blocks away, even in the center of the city, and things are much worse than my parents remembered when they grew up under Stalin, for example. You know, we went to visit my mother's neighborhood, which is in the center of town, and there were all these stray dogs menacing us. You know, this is in the middle of Russia's second city, you know. And my mother remembered all the anti-Semitism of growing up in that particular part of town. There was a kindergarten kid her age who would march in front of her when she would walk back from school shouting, "Nina, the Jewess, is walking down the street," you know. And my father remembered all these terrible things that had happened to him, and especially in his 20s. And so, you know, there were some fond memories they had of meeting each other, of dating and things like that. But overall, the sense I got was this was a place where terrible things happened. And the problems we had, you know, when I was growing up with them and with the way that they raised me, which was a lot harsher than Americans raise their children. There's no other way of saying that. You know, that's what it was. It's so explained by the kind of childhoods they had and the way they were treated by everyone around them. When I give a reading sometimes, you know, Americans will raise their hands during a reading and say, "I can't believe the way you were treated." And then the Russians would, you know, when it's time for the signing, they say, "Oh, my God, my mother called me little failure, too. And and I'm a lawyer now, and I'm still a little failure." Yeah. It's how we were raised, and it's how they were raised. And this is the inheritance we have, you know, for better or for worse, and a lot of time for worse. And I've had people crying to me as I sign their books. And it's both sad and hopefully it's a little liberating in the sense that we can all sense that there's a grander historical thing going on that's not just our individual relationships with our family. It's how the cookie crumbled, and it was a very crumbly cookie.
You get to Russia first. You get there first, and they come a little bit later. And you meet them, and you greet them when they arrive, and you ask them if they're tired. You know, if they're weary from their trip, and you ask them in speaking in Russian, which is such an interesting moment because you write about how you had been going to Russia pretty much every other year, retracing their steps, as you put it in the book, trying to, as you say, somehow make them my own. Mm-hmm. But with those words, you say you realize the truth of the matter. What do you mean?
Well, it's never really going to be my country. And those memories, I left it at a young age. I remember quite a bit. There were some happy memories, Crimea, invading the Crimea, you know, as a Russian kid, all these different things that happened. But writing my first book for my grandmother, which was this big event, the book about Lenin and his magical goose.
Yeah.
But
for cheese,
for cheese. She paid me in slices of cheese for each page I wrote, and even today, Random House pays me in cheese. but it's really their country, and the horrors of what had happened are theirs, and it's just trickle down stuff that I got from it. But for the most part, it's not my story, although I've appropriated into my story through these novel, so I almost feel like a thief in the night, you know, scouring for things that are not exactly his, but belong to me by association.
Yeah, it seemed like you say in the book that it made you feel that it was it helped you realize that you can just sit back and just listen to them. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, they have so many things to say.
Yeah.
Their memories are endless, you know, as happens when people spend the bulk of their lives in a country. So it was fascinating to hear, and in a way, it's sort of letting. I mean, the last chapter of the book, which is the chapter of coming back with them to Russia, there is not as much as editorial comment as there is in previous chapters.
Right.
I kind of just let them. I give them the microphone, or I'm videotaping them, and I just let them roam and say the things that they say, and then. And there's something wonderful about being able to let go and letting them really be who they are.
I want to have you read a section from that last chapter, if you don't mind. This is there's this moment you're in your parents' hotel room and you're waiting for your mom to get ready to go out to dinner, and you're left with your father alone talking with him. You want to say something about this before you read it?
Well, I think it speaks for itself a little bit,
but
let's see if I can add something after I finish reading it. Throughout this trip, I will capture little instances of my father reflected in shop windows, my parents looking younger than their ages, younger than many of the people around them, while I look at least two decades beyond my years, the dead graying hair, the sunken eyes, and all the imprints from the years of hard living, those two telltale lines cracked into my forehead. How did it happen that I have aged in tandem with the citizens of St. Petersburg, the city in which my parents have reached their own middle age, while they have seemingly reversed times like true Americans? My greatest fear, dying before they do. Growing up, it had been the reverse. I couldn't understand how to be on this earth without them. But now, every time I board a plane for some ragged destination, I feel their fear ascend throughout the air alongside me. I'll wash quickly under the armpits, my father says, while my mother continues her endless grooming, warning us that, quote, a woman is a long song. Settling in with his clean armpits, my father, the long journey behind him, begins to talk amiably, almost contentedly, about coming, quote-unquote, home. You know, little son, you could write an entire book about me. I'm not an extraordinary person, but because my life was so varied, all my studies and jobs in different places, there was so much that was interesting. You understand, little son, that just like you, I'm a lonely person by nature. I don't want to say that I like loneliness. Sometimes I like it. Sometimes I don't. Maybe this is the time for me to say, I love you, or better still, I am you. Maybe this is the flip side of the silence I have mastered, the inability to say what needs to be said until it's too late. My mother sticks her head out of the bathroom. Hey, guys, she says happily, I was so unattractive, but now I am refreshed. One thing I can add about, you know, just writing their dialogue is that it travels so easily from their mouth to the page.
Yeah.
A woman is a long song, my mother says. You know, most writers would die for this kind of dialogue. And my parents have supplied it in the course of four books. You know, everything they say is so memorable that I used to come home after a dinner with them and just write down pages. And, you know, after the iPhone came out, I was just able to type stuff in as they were speaking sometimes, you know, because it's... And at one point, I think it was my mother that says, oh, the spy is listening to us, you know, because they know that as a writer, it's how do you say no to sentences like that?
I wonder, I know for a while during this process, after you had finished it and published it, your parents hadn't read it. Have they yet?
I don't think so. Yeah. I think that it's a question of language. They need to wait for the Russian translation to come out. That's usually when they read and understand my works. And the three novels have been translated to Russian, but no Russian rights for this book have been sold yet. So it's possible they will never really read it.
Do you feel anxious about them reading it when they finally do?
Well, you know, I think that it's written with love, and I think some of the greater reviews about it, the more important reviews about it, all talk about the fact that it is, in a way, a kind of love song.
Yeah.
But I can't, you know, the way I write is hopefully suffused with enough honesty that there are no heroes in this book for the most part, maybe one or two people. Everyone is incredibly, at least I've tried to make them incredibly nuanced, myself included.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to be faithful to what it was like to grow up with them as parents, with my grandparents as well, with the people I loved, my first girlfriends. You know, this is what a memoir should be, I always thought. It has to be as honest as possible. Sure, you should use artistry. Each sentence should sing as much as it could, but it shouldn't overwhelm what is the truth of the experience that one had.
It's Gary Steingart, the author of the novels Super Sad, True Love Story, Absurdistan, and The Russian Debutante's Handbook, his latest memoir, Little Failure. He joined us today from a studio at Columbia University where he teaches creative writing. Gary Steingart, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our theme music, composed by The Moth and the Flame. Our thanks to Taylor Allman today. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.